to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. Yet another shipwreck has been discovered in Lake Michigan. And, you know, the guy that led the group that found it is with us in the studio right now. Brendan Balod is back with us. He's president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, and he's going to share details of the ship they've found. And I hope you'll join in with your own questions as we move along today. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. Brendan Balod, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Great to have you back. Well, this summer you served as the principal investigator for the search of the sunken wreck of the F.J. King. And that ship sank in Lake Michigan in 1886. And you found it. How big a deal is that discovery?
Well, for us, it was huge. Yeah. We had found a couple of other vessels out there over the years. in fact, every year I think we've found a couple because new sources have become available. It's I wouldn't say it's easy to find them, not all of them, but this one was special to us because it had been really elusive. A number of groups had tried to find it over the years. Even when it was lost in 1886, the keeper of the Cana Island Lighthouse had reported that its masts were breaking the surface. And they asked a revenue cutter to come and take the masts out because it was a hazard to navigation. When the revenue cutter got there a few days later, it was gone. It had just vanished. Fast forward to the 1970s. People are looking for the ship. It's become part of the cultural history of Door County. People want to find this, ship. And no one can find it. Commercial fishermen are bringing up pieces of a schooner in their nets off Cana Island Light. But when they go out to the site where the pieces are brought up, there's nothing there. It had gotten so elusive that the local dive club offered a $1,000 reward for its discovery. We didn't really expect to find it,
But you did in pretty short order. Let's back up. What was the describe that ship, the F.J. King? What kind of a ship was it?
She was a canal schooner. So this is a ship that was built for the grain trade on the Great Lakes in the 1860s. She was built at Toledo, Ohio in 1867. And to give that some context, right after the Civil War, right, the Lake Michigan port cities, on particularly in Wisconsin and Chicago, were the biggest primary grain markets in the world. More grain was flowing out of Milwaukee than any place else in the world. Millionaires were being minted every year by delivering this prairie gold to the cities of the East. Because if you were eating a ham sandwich in New York City in 1867, the wheat that made that bread came from Wisconsin. That's not that way anymore. But these vessels, there was just a huge fleet of them. There were hundreds and hundreds of these schooners. And they call them canal schooners because they were built to go through the Welland Canal around Niagara Falls. So they could trade with Oswego, New York. And most of their cargoes would go to Buffalo and Oswego and then down the New York State Canal systems. That's sort of the context. These ships, by the time the F.J. King was lost in 1886, there were probably 2,000 of vessels this plying the Great Lakes. And, they had to go out in the fall when the weather was its worst. Because that's
when the wheat came in.
And the coal had to be delivered and all the raw goods because, for processing over the winter. And they had no modern weather forecasting. They'd sail out into the gales of November, sometimes never to be seen again.
So the gales of November caused it? What caused the ship to sink?
Well, in this case, she was in bad weather. It was probably 8 to 10 foot waves, but the weather isn't what did her in. The F.J. King was lost because of age and decrepitude is what I'd say. Now, she had just been given a rebuild, but it was her upper works. They put new decks on her. They actually added a third mast to her because they wanted she had outlived her usefulness as a grain carrier. So on the Great Lakes, if a vessel had so much hull rot and was so old, it couldn't carry grain anymore. So they decided to put her in the iron ore trade. Well, iron ore cargoes are pretty heavy. And they're very hard on these old hulls, and they didn't re-caulk this hull. And it hadn't carried iron ore in years. When it had left Escanaba, Michigan, with a cargo of raw iron ore, and it was coming down the Door Peninsula. It was bound for Chicago, And when it got off the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal, they started to leak and leak bad. They put all the men to the pumps and they turned because they couldn't make it. The wind wasn't favorable. It's a schooner. They had to tack and jibe. They couldn't get into the Sturgeon Bay Ship Canal. So they ran north for Bailey's Harbor, North Bay. They wanted to beach it. And the men were losing the battle. And they'd been up for many, many hours fighting for their lives, literally. And as they came off of the Can Island light, they saw the lights of a schooner approaching, the La Petite. And they knew that that was their time to abandon the ship. If they didn't get off then, they were going down with the ship. So they got in the little yawl boat, rowed for the lights of the schooner that was coming. And as they did, the bow of the F.J. King slid down beneath the waves and the iron ore rushed forward. And the force of the wind blowing backward from that blew the rear cabin 50 feet in the air. The captain's papers went flying all over the place. There was a huge explosion sound as the stern of the vessel literally ripped open. And the men were picked up by the schooner and taken to shore.
And you know all this because probably because of the captain, I would guess, would have had to file a report.
Well, the captain did. He filed a rec report with the Customs Bureau in his own hand. And in the rec report, he said he thought he was about 6 miles off Can Island Light. We questioned that because that's where Vunen had been looking. And that area had been searched a lot by a lot of people. What happens when we reinvestigate a wreck? It's kind of like a cold case, like reinvestigating a cold case. When I go into it, I'll sometimes start from scratch. Like I won't look at any previous researcher's work. I'll just go in and start collecting raw data. And in this case, we found a piece of evidence that nobody had seen before. It had been missed by other researchers. And that was that the Canna Island lighthouse keeper, when he said he saw the masts breaking the surface, he told one news outlet what the range and bearing was to the masts, and only one news outlet. And I found that newspaper account that said how far out and in what direction the masts were. So I thought, well, you know, we should reinvestigate that. Just rule that bottom out, you know. So I drew a 2-mile by 2-mile box around where he said the masts were, and the ship was a quarter of a mile away. It was hiding in plain sight.
Oh, my gosh. Brendan Baylott, our guest today, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. We're talking about his group finding the F.J. King sank in Lake Michigan in 1886, and all kinds of people have been trying to find it. Questions about the King or about other ships, perhaps. They found five, I think, in the last couple of years. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or if you'd like, you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today. Larry Mueller here as we talk with Brendan Baylott, president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association, about the finding of the F.J. King ship that sank in Lake Michigan in 1886. Questions or comments? I hope you'll join in. Number's 800-642-1234 or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. A quick mention, coming up at 11:45, we'll talk to a couple of folks relating to the Portage County Historical Society. And at 12:30, we'll talk to best-selling author David Sedaris. But right now, we're talking shipwrecks with Brendan and having some fun doing it. I hope you'll join in. On June 28th, your team chartered a tour vessel to look for the ship out from Bailey's Harbor. How confident were you that you were going to find it?
Well, we really didn't expect to find it. WUA is a citizen science group where we provide opportunities for the public to participate in underwater archaeology. And, you know, more and more people aren't scuba diving to do that. We're doing it through remote sensing. So we're bringing people out and giving them a chance to, you know, use our side scan sonar, to use our remote operated vehicles, and to really participate in underwater archaeology through remote sensing. And that was the point of this. We wanted to get people out on the boat and kind of show them how the sausage was made, so to speak, you know, and let them participate. And there was a chance we'd find the wreck. It was exciting. You know, and we told him that. We said, no guarantee. We did have people sign an archaeological stewardship agreement. What we don't want is we want to give the state a chance to document the site pre-disturbance. So our state underwater archaeologist, Tamara Thompson, is a close working partner of ours. And all the wrecks we find, she goes out and documents them very carefully before they're released to the public. So everyone had to sign this agreement to say, oh, we're not going to talk.
Keep your mouth shut.
And they were really good about it. So we got out there and we started searching that grid. And we had made one pass. We turned and we were coming back on our second pass. And, you know, we joke around and say, keep your eye on the screen, you know, something might happen. And all of a sudden, we see this big object start to crawl across the screen. It was the first thing we'd seen. And we could see rocks. We could see all sorts of features. But all of a sudden, we see hatches. We see a deck. We just couldn't believe it. We were pinching ourselves. It was just a surreal moment. People got their cell phones out, started taking pictures of the screen. Some people started high-fiving. And I immediately measured it on the screen because we can do that. And it was the exact right length. And we knew we had found the FJ King.
Oh, man. That, you know, the technology on that is really, I mean, and this technology has improved a lot and also probably gotten a little more, a little less expensive over time.
Yeah, our side-scanning sonar that we have was made in Sweden by a company called Deep Vision, and they gave us a grant to get it, which was very nice of them. It's an archaeological sonar, but it also can find things that are quite a distance out. We could see about 900 feet away from the boat on either channel. And so we were covering a pretty good-sized swath of the bottom with it. But our remote-operated vehicles are really kind of what people were excited about because we put them in the water right as soon as we found it. We anchored the boat over it, and we said, okay, swim them down. And our members got to be the first people to lay eyes on that ship since 1886. And everyone on the boat got to swim those ROVs around and see that ship as it lay on the bottom. It was an amazing moment. We got video of it. All of our participants got to, you know, take part in it and in our events following it. So it was a really great experience. And we're going to do it again next year with a different wreck.
we'll talk about that in a few minutes, I should say. But what an exciting moment for everyone. How deep was what was the depth there?
Well, the FJ King lies in between 110 and 140 feet of water. It's on a bit of a hillside. She is in pretty good shape, so we expected to find what we call fillet of schooner because she was carrying iron ore, and when those things hit the bottom with iron ore, they blow up. Instead, what we found was a ship that was mostly intact. She stands upright and intact on the bottom. The only thing that's missing is her rear deck has been blown off. And she has some damage to her starboard bow where she struck bottom. But otherwise, she's standing upright and intact. She stands about 18 feet off the bottom. She's huge. I mean, the size of a large building, really. This is a huge object to have been missing for so long.
That is amazing. And the photo you do on your site, you've got a photo, is really almost surreal.
That is a photogrammetry model. So our state underwater archaeologist, Tamara Thompson, and Zach Whitrock, who is one of their volunteers, dove the wreck a few months after we found it. And they created a model by taking over 5,000 high-resolution images, which they then have stitched together into a 3D spatial model using software. And we can give tours of the wreck using, you know, a 3D virtual reality headset where you can literally walk down the deck. You can walk around the wreck on the bottom and look up at it and reach out and almost touch it. You can look down into the holds and see the iron ore down there. So we like to provide that 3D immersive experience for people so that they, but also those models show us what the wreck was like, because it's not going to be like that in 50 years or 100 years. They're perishable. So it's important that we use that to document as well.
And we have that 3D image. We have a link to that 3D image on today's program at the Larry Mueller Show. If you can go there, we'll be posting this show about 2 hours after the show's over, and you'll be able to take a look at it. Go to today's date at the Larry Mueller Show. Linda in Middleton has a question for you. Hi, Linda.
Yeah. Hi. Very fascinating. I'm wondering, are you ever think you're going to find the French schooner, the Griffin?
That's an interesting question. I have looked for the Griffin, not as a member of the WUAA, but personally. And I actually did a lot of work to translate the original letters from the French explorer La Salle about 15 years ago. He wrote about an 80-page letter where he discusses the debris from the Griffin that he was shown and the last accounts of the Griffin. We believe the Griffin disappeared off Sechouart Point. Translated into English, that means only choice point. That's the only place you can stop between the Door Peninsula and St. Ignace for shelter. We don't believe the Griffin is going to be an intact ship. We believe because of her age and the shallowness of the water up there and then the
wave action.
We believe she's going to have been reduced to a debris field and she'll be found through her anchors and her anvils. She was carrying a lot of ironwork to build a keel boat to go down the Mississippi River. And so that is a search that has to be done with what we call a magnetometer that looks for iron on the bottom as opposed to a side scan sonar. It's going to be a long time before she's found. This is not a ship that's going to be found easily or visually, and the search area is large. It's about 100 square miles.
And a magnetometer, what area would it, you know, as you pass over?
Not very good. A magnetometer, you have to get pretty close. It varies with the size of the ferrous object, but you have to be pretty much within maybe 100 yards, 50 yards, even closer to pick up an anvil. So it's just a long search, and it's going to be a hard search.
And that was, the Griffin was, when was that?
1679. She is the first decked vessel on the Western Great Lakes, and also the Western Great Lakes' first shipwreck. One of the biggest enduring mysteries on the Great Lakes. I'm well-versed in the wreck. I don't know that I'll go looking for it again. It's just, it's a long way to go. The weather's always bad up there. And there are other wrecks that are easier to find.
Okay, Linda, there you go. Thanks so much for calling. And you could join in, too. Number to call, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Give us your questions about shipwrecks or email us to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. So the citizen scientists, how does one become a shipwreck investigator or a citizen scientist?
Well, I mean, you don't have to join WUA, but we'd like it if you did. It's $20 a year, WUAA.org. And we put out an announcement about all our upcoming fieldwork trainings and projects. We give trainings on our equipment, and the projects are first come, first served. People sign up and get a space on the boat, and they come out with us. You don't have to have any special qualifications.
Oh.
If you're a member of the WUAA and you'd like to sign up for a project, we encourage it. We want the public to get involved and to experience this with us. It's our reason for being.
So the F.J. King, when the scientists, the citizen scientists, got to take part, they weren't diving down 150 feet.
We do everything via remote operated vehicle.
Yeah,
scuba diving. Although we do have members that scuba dive and draw the wrecks, most of our membership does it through remote sensing because it opens up the field. It opens up the ability to look at these wrecks to a much broader audience.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Let's go to Kurt in Chippewa Falls. Kurt, your turn. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. What do you think is the human psychology behind this fascination with finding sunken ships?
Why do we want to find them?
I think it's sort of the cold case aspect of it. People like to, you know, a good mystery, and they like it even better when it gets solved. And in the case of these shipwrecks, you know, you've just heard the question about the Griffin. It's a really enduring mystery. When we find the ships, it tells us a lot about what really happened. You know, what happened when it was lost? And, you know, why wasn't it found? In the case of the F.J. King, you know, the captain wasn't quite sure where he was. It was 1 a.m. when it went down. And he couldn't really see how far he was from shore. But those kind of things, I think, carry a fascination. I think also the old treasure hunting ethos, although on the Great Lakes, that's not really a thing anymore since the passage of conservation laws. But, you know, that's part of it. The thought about finding a shipwreck and finding treasure that also attracts people.
Kurt, thank you very much for calling. Let's turn to Trouble in Lodi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. It's a very interesting show. I'm interested in knowing if your guest knows what materials the ship, the King, was made out of. And I'm assuming it's made out of wood. And I'm curious to know what kinds of wood it was made out of. Black walnut? Or black locust?
Yeah.
It's an excellent question. So we know a lot about the shipbuilding on the Great Lakes because it was a huge industry. Almost every port city had a major shipyard, and they followed very standard methods. By that time, the insurance industry, by the 1840s, there were prescribed standards for how Great Lakes vessels had to be built to carry cargoes and to be insured. They had to be built of white oak, and in the case of the F.J. King, in the neighborhood of 20 acres of white oak forest had to be cut down, virgin white oak forest, to build that ship. Shipbuilding on the Great Lakes gradually moved westward as the forests were depleted in the eastern United States. By the time of the 1850s, 1860s, the yards in Manitowoc and Milwaukee had come online, mostly because there wasn't much wood in the east anymore. The masts could be made of other things, often pine, because you had to have, they were made in two pieces. There was the main part of the mast and then the top mast, which was joined to it. Masts could be, on the F.J. King, the vessel was 140 feet long, so the masts were probably around 140 feet tall. So finding that kind of pine in the area also became quite difficult. But, white oak, and the masts were made of pine. There was little else. It was almost all white oak.
And not much metal involved.
Well, there actually was quite a bit of iron.
Was.
The fastenings on a schooner are heavy iron pieces, the size of your forearm.
Okay.
They would join the keelsons together with very heavy iron fastenings. The frames would be joined with these heavy iron fastenings. And actually, when we find a ship that was lost under, say, a sandy beach, and it's completely buried, that's sort of how we can identify it, is if you use a magnetometer, you measure where the big metal pieces are, put flags in the sand, and then put a string around the whole thing, and you measure it. You can tell what's under the sand because of the iron fittings on these ships.
Oh, okay. Trouble, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. And I did want to take a moment. On November 10th, we will be talking about the Edmund Fitzgerald on the show. And I didn't want to, for those of you who are interested in shipwrecks and there's always a lot of interest in the Edmund Fitzgerald, we'll be doing that show on November 10th. So that's going to be a lot of fun as well. The shipwreck itself was discovered on June 28th and in 2 hours, I think it was. We were on the water for 2 hours, right?
That's about right, yeah.
Oh, man, after all those years, and then to find it in a couple hours. But the public announcement of the find wasn't made until September 15th, so it took 2.5 months to make that discovery known.
Well, I think the important part was that we cooperate very closely with the Wisconsin Historical Society and the state underwater archaeologist. It's important to us that the sites be documented archaeologically pre-disturbance, so before anybody gets out there and can do anything. It took some time for them to have the staff available and the time. They're very busy. They only have 2 staff members. So kudos to Tamara Thompson and her staff for coming out there and doing such a wonderful model and helping us tell the story. When we did put out the press release, and we do this, when we find a wreck, we put out a national press release, and there's a reason for that. We have what I consider sort of a magic 2 weeks when we announce a wreck to educate the public about its significance. We learned from hard experience that anonymous wrecks are the most vulnerable wrecks. A good case in point is the Wisconsin's most historic shipwreck, the schooner Gallinipper off of Sheboygan. She was found in 1991 when snagged by some commercial fishermen. Her find was never reported. Well, a small group of divers knew where it was, and you know, in the ensuing years, they cut the ship's ornate scroll figurehead off and stole the steering wheel. Neither of those artifacts have ever been seen again. 10 years later, the ship was finally identified as the Gallinipper, as a fur trading schooner owned by the Dousman family, you know, a very important family here in Wisconsin. Had that ship's identity been known, had its story been told, those artifacts probably never would have been stolen. And so we try to really tell the story of these ships. We try to get the community involved. We try to get the community to adopt that ship into their cultural history. So, you know, Bailey's Harbor, Cana Island Lighthouse, you know, that's now part of the stories of those communities. And that helps not only preserve the shipwreck, but it helps those communities through tourism, through storytelling. In this case, it's a deep wreck, only accessible to scuba divers, but many of the wrecks can be visited by paddleboarders and kayakers. So an important part of their cultural history.
So I was, I don't know if I should have been surprised, but it seemed surprising to me that the discovery of the F.J. King was, it was covered by the New York Times, CNN, People magazine, the Smithsonian magazine. So why do you think the national organizations, media organizations, were so interested in what you found?
Well, I think part of it is that we have a track record of doing this. We build up a database of media outlets. When we do a press release, we put it out to them. We also do a media kit where we put pre-approved images up, and we give a very nice pre-written, you know, press kit, talking points. So that really, it's kind of their work is done for them if they want to run the story. I think part of it, too, though, is this fascination with shipwrecks. People, you know, a mystery solved after so many years. It does have that appeal for people. And in talking to those reporters who covered the story, they tell me that those stories just get a lot of clicks no matter where they are. But particularly in America on the Great Lakes. I think it's just because a lot of people have roots here. There still is a big community of people whose ancestors sailed on the Great Lakes. And it really is an important part of the story of the building of America, the industrialization of America. You know, the Great Lakes were that freshwater freeway that brought all the raw goods to the east. You know, and some people say that, for example, if Siberia had been connected to Moscow by a system of lakes, they would have developed into a superpower, but they just didn't have a way to transport raw goods like we had here on the Great Lakes. And so that story is still very appealing to people and an important part of our history.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and you kind of mentioned this, but Wisconsin oversees shipwrecks near its shores, I think, differently from, I think, other states for sure.
We have a slightly different cultural approach that really started with our state historical societies. Way of dealing with shipwrecks. So in 1987, most of the shipwrecks, the vast majority on the Great Lakes, were given stewardship by the states through the Abandoned Shipwreck Act. So Michigan, for example, decided to start an underwater preserve system, which was really designed for sport divers. It was a tourism resource. Whereas Wisconsin decided to approach all our sites as archaeological sites. And the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeological Association was founded, actually, to help document those sites and tell their stories. Whereas in Michigan, there was no documentation. There was no storytelling. There was just come and dive the shipwrecks and, you know, pay and put money in our communities. Not a bad approach, but it hastened the destruction of their wrecks. Whereas here, we put our wrecks on the National Register of Historic Places. We have more wrecks on the National Register of Historic Places than any other state in the Union. And it's because we try to tell the stories of the wrecks and establish their historical significance so that people respect them and don't damage them and that communities can leverage them as part of their community history for tourism.
Yeah. And I'm sure the F.J. King, if it hasn't been done already, will be put up for that nomination for inclusion.
It has been nominated to the National Register. Tammy Thompson, I think just completed the nomination. Of course, we helped with the research, but yeah, it's a process we go through. And once the ship is named to the National Register, we're going to release its location to sport divers. We hope to release it at our annual event, the Ghost Ships Festival, which is held in March in Manitowoc. We also will have a number of other major shipwreck discoveries there from people from across the lakes. But the F.J. King will be discussed there, and we will actually release the location, hopefully.
Pretty cool place to announce all that. The shipbuilders community. Yeah,
definitely. We love having our event in Manitowoc. It's we put our remote operated vehicles in the swimming pool, and you know, people and children can come and swim the ROVs around some little pseudo shipwrecks that we put in the pool. And we have a lot of vendors and, you know, all sorts of people giving presentations on new shipwreck discoveries, on underwater technology. It's quite an event.
We'll have to get you back at about that time, just ahead of it, so we can sort of promote that, because I think a lot of people would be interested in it for sure.
Yeah.
Mark and Sister Bay, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, I was in the Coast Guard Auxiliary, and my commander, he used to be a historian. He worked in Milwaukee, and he often talked about the 10,000 or more shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and that they only really found about 4,500 of them. And I had a relative that was on the Edmund Fitzgerald and went down, Oliver J. Buck Champeau. So that was a close cousin of mine.
Oh, well, Mark, I'm sorry for that, but your information, I think, is spot on, is it not?
He's definitely right about that. Probably around 10,000 wrecks, give or take 1,000. Depends on what you call a wreck, too. A lot of ships, you know, didn't sink out in the lake. They went under the ashore on a beach. A lot were towed out and scuttled when they outlived their usefulness. So if you add up all the ships that are buried somewhere or that are out on the bottom, it's probably around 10,000. Interesting thing, I went through our databases. I was involved in creating a database of all the ships ever lost on the Great Lakes over a period of about 20 years, a group of about 20 maritime historians. It was a collaborative effort. And I went through that database and took out only those that went down out in the lake and are still missing. It turns out that Lake Michigan still has 220 ships that are lost, that are missing out in deep water, and have not been found. Comparatively, the other lakes have less. Lake Huron has only about half that. Lake Superior only has about a quarter of that. But a lot of those ships now are getting harder and harder to find. They're farther from shore. But what I do is I go through that list and I prioritize them, you know, and I reinvestigate them. And so, you know, for me, the F.J. King was sort of in the top 10, right? And I thought, well, I'm going to reinvestigate that. It's like opening up a cold case file. And I started looking through it, and I was digging for new resources, things that people – that didn't exist when it was first investigated. And that's sort of how we found the account. So, yeah, those numbers are about right. And, yeah, the Fitz, I think, also has a special place in Great Lakes memory. And with the 50th anniversary coming up, you know, remembering not just the ship – but the people who were lost on it and the story it tells of, you know, really that industrial commerce on the Great Lakes and how it helped build America, all those sailors on the Fitz and the many, many thousands that went before that gave their lives do an important part in telling that story.
Well, your group, this is the fifth ship you found in 3 years. That's a pretty good record.
I think it's because we have been spending more time at it lately. We used to focus more on documenting ships that and sites that had already been found, inland sites too. We don't just do Great Lakes work. We for example, we did an archaeological side scan survey of the bottom of the Crawfish River off Aztalan. We've done Devil's Lake. We've done a number of inland sites, but. These sites, because we've purchased this equipment, we've started to look for shipwrecks more. And we take a very scientific and methodical approach to it. When we especially in terms of what we choose to look for, to put it bluntly, we look for shipwrecks we think we can find.
Well, you were teasing me a little earlier about another find.
Not another find, but another one we're looking for. Yes, we're currently out in the field looking for another ship. I don't know that we'll find it. It's a pretty difficult search. But we always have a few. Now, we have next year, we're hoping to do the same type of project again, where we take a group of citizen scientists out on a large boat, and we look for a ship that is still missing. And we have a ship in mind, but you know, these have to be approved by our board of directors. We sure. actually have a project and field work committee that reviews things. And we actually have real credentialed yeah. underwater archaeologists who we run this stuff by before we go and do a project. We don't just sort of shoot from the hip. But if they decide to approach the project, we're going to do it again. And we'll take another group of citizen scientists out and, you know, we're probably not going to find it. But honestly, we try to.
But you're going to have a heck of a lot of fun looking.
Yeah, we do. It is. It's huge fun. Everybody really enjoys it. We have a good time. We get to know new people with like interests. It's a great time. So we're looking forward to it. And we hope to do it again and find another shipwreck next year with the public.
Brendan, it's always a pleasure. Thanks so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. Look forward to your next visit. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Larry.
Brendan Balod is president of the Wisconsin Underwater Archaeology Association. He's always got some really cool stuff to talk about, and look forward to another visit from him down the road. Up next, we'll talk about the transformation of the Portage County Historical Society with Executive Director John Henry, and also joining us, Janet Seymour, who is the Outreach Director of the Wisconsin Historical Society. That next, I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks so much for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here. You know, over the I think it's the past 5 years, the Portage County Historical Society has restored historic buildings. They've created exhibits celebrating local women, athletes, and musicians, and offered many walking tours. And with us today is John Harry, with me in the studio. John Harry is Executive Director of the Portage County Historical Society. John, thanks for joining us today.
I'm so excited to be here. You don't know how many times I've been like one call away from getting on the air, so I had to work real hard to get here today. I came all the way down.
I'm glad you're here. Janet Seymour with us as well. Janet is the Outreach Director for the Wisconsin Historical Society. And Janet, welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning, Larry. Good to see you, and good to hear from John, too.
So these two are going to tell us how local history preservation can strengthen a community, certainly strengthen their community, and I bet it can strengthen yours as well as you listen in. Just a quick mention, at 12:30, we'll hear from humorist David Sedaris, but right now, what do you appreciate about your local historical society? What has it taught you about your area? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you can send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Jenna, let me start with you. Last month, the Portage County Historical Society was awarded the Reuben Gold Thwaites Trophy. What is that award? And maybe talk about how recipients are chosen.
Sure. So each year, the Wisconsin Historical Society's Board of Curators awards organizations and individuals throughout the state for outstanding work in history. And the Reuben Gold Thwaites Trophy for Excellence in Local History is the highest honor that the Wisconsin Historical Society and Board of Curators can share. And so being selected to receive the Reuben Gold Thwaites Trophy is certainly an honor. And this award has been in place since 1958. It is a traveling trophy that goes around the state honoring the work of one local history affiliate each year. And so the Thwaites Trophy recognizes excellence in collecting, preserving, and sharing history and achievement in serving a community for over a period of at least 5 years.
And it's very distinguished award. Who was Reuben Gold Thwaites, by the way?
Oh, that's a great question. Reuben Gold Thwaites was the Society's second director. And Reuben created the local history affiliate program that we know today. And here in 2025, the Wisconsin Historical Society works with more than 445 local history affiliates. And in 1898, Reuben Gold Thwaites created the local history affiliate program as one way to honor Wisconsin's 50th anniversary of statehood. He wanted to ensure that the State Historical Society was connected to county and local efforts to preserve history so that that shared work and shared mission would strengthen Wisconsin's ability to share our history across all communities and all counties. So this program was the first in the United States and started in 1898. The first two affiliates were Green Bay and Ripon. And we have a very active and robust local history community here today in Wisconsin that we can all be proud of. And the Portage County Historical Society is an excellent example of that good work that is happening around the state.
And this is not an award you're going to win every year.
Yes, and actually, I think there's a requirement. You can win the award more than once, but you have to wait 25 years before you can apply again. And so this is the second time. I'll let John share those details, but the second time that the Portage County Historical Society has received this honor. But there is a 25-year period.
John, you don't look old enough to have been there 25 years ago.
Oh, but. Yes, I'm. Yeah, I just I looked younger 4 years ago when I started the job. I'll tell you that.
Well, what does this award mean to you and Portage County Historical Society?
I think it's a validation that we're heading in the right direction with things. A lot changed with the hiring of my position in 2021. So our organization was founded in 1952, and I want to clear something up because this gets confused all the time. Portage County is where Stevens Point is.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
City of Portage is Columbia County. And if I could change one thing, it's so hard to, some people get those all screwed up and anyway, and there's also a Portage County in Ohio that really confuse things too. But our organization was founded in 1952 and it was all volunteer then up until 2021. It was run by some very passionate people. And so it really, it became this community asset that really laid a great foundation for the growth that's taken place over the last few years.
Yeah. Well, regarding your first comment, a person that is part of Wisconsin Public Radio asked that very question, is Portage in Portage County? And I had to say, no, it's not in Portage County.
They drew the county line straight north from Portage when they were, plotting everything out, and then they just kept shrinking Portage County into the borders it has today, meanwhile leaving the city of Portage not in Portage County. There's your trivia.
Oh, my gosh. Well, you know what? Mark and Bloomer's got something for us. So let's go there. Mark, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hey, every summer up here, I'm just up the road from East Barron County, and the Barron County Historical Society, they have a living, what do you call it, with all the old buildings and stuff, and you can walk around. But every summer, they have day camps for the youth, and my daughter goes in her prairie dress and they collect the eggs from the chickens and they even get to butcher a chicken and eat chicken. And it's just so much fun. They make history come alive. It's just so beautiful.
Oh, Mark, thanks for calling. Janet, a comment? I'll get you to join in here.
Oh, that's great. Such a nice recognition for the excellent work that folks do at the Barron County Historical Society. They're the Pioneer Village Museum. The team there offers wonderful summer opportunities and year-round activities too, but the educational summer camps that they offer for kids are a great opportunity for the community. So it's really nice to hear that.
Yeah, thanks, Mark, for calling. John, you mentioned you were hired as the executive director, and you were the organization's first paid staff member. And that's a big deal.
Yes.
And I wonder how you viewed. Did you view this as hiring as a step toward really significantly changing the organization?
Yes. So I'll start at the where we are now, and then I'll go back to the beginning. So where we are now is, it's almost 4 years since my position and I was hired. And now we have 3.5 staff positions. So it's me, an office administrator who is also our volunteer coordinator. We have a curator of our collections, and then an educator to get to the caller's point there is education is, one of the tenets of our mission, so, and one of our values. So, those are really important. How this all came into being, though, was when my first career was actually in radio.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. So we're in sort of a club here. But when I was switching careers, logical career switch, right, going from radio into history and public history.
I was thinking about the same thing myself. No, not really. Go ahead.
I basically was trying to figure out how to get into graduate school. I went to the great people at UW-Stevens Point. I happened to be working back in that area. And they were like, get active in the local historical society. So I showed up and they said, you want to join the board? Not knowing what that meant. And so I was on the board for a little more than a year, and I kind of, great, passionate people and great organization that was kind of not really going in a direction. There was a lot of ideas and things happening, and there wasn't a lot of awareness in the community. And so when I went to graduate school, I actually paired my history master's with a nonprofit management graduate certificate, and, serendipity intervened, and this job kind of happened as my wife and I went to grad school in Milwaukee. As we were trying to leave Milwaukee to go back up to Stevens Point, and this job happened to be available. So it all worked out that way, where I thought if we could really install some better systems, policies, better know-how of how to run a nonprofit, not just a museum, I think this organization can thrive, and I think this award is proof.
Yeah, I think it is. Janet, how are most local historical society are run by volunteers? And not paid staff.
In Wisconsin, that is true. We collect data from local history affiliates annually. So we know that about 75% of local history organizations in Wisconsin are volunteer-led endeavors. And of course, the 25% or so of museums and historical societies here in the state that have paid staff, volunteers are, of course, essential to their operations and their mission. So local history is very much a volunteer-supported and led activity in Wisconsin.
I can see the benefits of having a paid staff, but are there benefits of just a volunteer, having an all-volunteer?
Well, I think you see that in organizations that do have paid staff or a small staff, that volunteers are essential to the connecting to the community and serving the needs of the community. So there are many organizations here in Wisconsin that are volunteer-led, and many of them are seasonally operated or are smaller facilities. And so oftentimes that's an appropriate and manageable effort. It's still a lot of work and a lot of volunteer hours. But for larger county historical societies, public museums, etc., those often do have paid staff, but they are supported by their board of directors and volunteers, community-supported organizations.
Well, we, Frank and Springbrook, we'll get to you after our quick look at the news here. Our guests, John Harry and Janet Seymour, as we talk about the Portage County Historical Society. And they will be back. We'll take that quick look at the news, and then we'll be back. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here visiting with a couple of folks today. John Harry is Executive Director of the Portage County Historical Society. So we're talking about the work the Historical Society is doing there. Janet Seymour with us as well. She's Outreach Director of the Wisconsin Historical Society. We're talking about the work on restoring historic buildings that they're doing. We'll certainly talk about that. We'll talk about preserving local heritage. And I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Frank in Springbrook's been hanging on for a while, so let's go to Frank. Thank you for calling, Frank. What's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Say, I heard years ago that there was an English teacher in Spooner who had the senior class. One of their projects they always had every year is to interview one of their older relatives, write a biography, document local history. And then, you know, they got a grade on it, and that paper would go to the Historical Society. Have you heard of other programs like that in the state of Wisconsin?
I can take this.
Yeah. Go ahead,
yeah.
John.
Yeah, we have – oral histories are a really integral part of saving local stories. And so that's actually a really great idea. So I appreciate you sharing with that of how we can integrate, you know, that work into schools as well. But we have done our own oral history projects. We did an exhibit on women's athletics history, and we did oral histories on that. And, you know, those are really powerful things because two of those people are deceased now. So it's really great that we were able to capture those stories before these people passed away. And what we've have launched this year is actually a live oral history series to do with our music. We have a music history exhibit, and one of the people in the exhibit came through the summer. His name is Bob Ray, W-R-A-Y, and Bob is a session musician, but he grew up in Stevens Point. But he worked down in Nashville and Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and is on 30, you know, over 30 number one hit country records, from everybody to Johnny Cash to Ray Charles to Hank Williams. So we actually had an audience for that one. So there's a lot of different ways you can do oral histories, but, you know, that's, I think, one of the most powerful things you can do is record an oral history, especially with a loved one. We just actually ran a workshop on how to do that as an organization with some of our members and community members showed up to that. So that's really important.
Janet, anything to add there?
I appreciate the focus on preserving community history through oral history. And there are a number of local historical societies that I've talked with over the years that have done similar projects to that. So I think there are certainly pockets of that happening in different places around the state, including up in Spooner.
John, what are the biggest challenges in your mind about the Portage County Historical Society?
I think that I have two answers to that. First is roles and governance, which is, you know, the most flashy topics you can talk about. But you gotta, you know, I think a lot of people get involved in a local historical society because they're passionate about the mission area, right? They care about historical preservation and historical education. And I think what the next step then is, how do you run a nonprofit? And how do you actually assume a role as a board member? What does that mean? How is that different than just being a volunteer who shows up maybe on the weekends? And how do you run the business of the nonprofit? Is if you don't get that under your feet, you're never going to grow. You have to have that together. And then to kind of tie on to that, I mean, fundraising is always something that has to be done continuously. And, you know, my position, the thing that kickstarted my position was a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Well, those grants don't exist anymore. And so the fundraising challenge is moving forward so that we can maintain the very important parts of our mission of keeping our community stories alive and preserving the past for future generations so that we can build community through that. It's a tough road ahead for, I would say, most local historical societies. We, you know, support it just as WPR is going through different mm-hmm. things with different cuts and things too. You know, it's really important that our communities step up philanthropically to support these types of things.
And I think they step up. You have you've instituted some great things that I think have helped make that community stand up and take notice.
I think that's the first thing when I came into this job was saying, I don't want people to say, I never heard of you before. So there's no point in being a hidden gem. Then you're not, you know, that's not a gem, right? So we, you know, from the, you know, early in 2022 and early in my tenure in this job, we started doing a lot. We always did some tours, but we started doing a lot more tours. We concentrated on when we do community exhibits, are the communities we're representing involved in those exhibits? Are we telling those stories correctly? Especially when we get down to more sensitive topics. And so we have a lot of, you know, I look at my wife is always like, you know, you don't have to do so much. And I'm like, I do, because it's important, right? We need to keep our communities engaged. And I think the biggest thing is every time we add something, people keep showing up. And so our community is hungry for this content and to feel connected in this way.
So one of the things that you've done is restoring, I was at 14.
A lot.
Structures in Portage County?
So across four different sites, we have 14 different structures. And not some of them need some more work, but you know, they're all usable at this point, too. And we have plans for future growth. So in Stevens Point, we have a historic synagogue that we're working on what's called a historic structure report right now, which will kind of guide us to another layer of restoration. Because there was that building's from 1905. But they did a restoration in the 50s that kind of mid-centuried it in a different way. And so kind of seeing, like, what do we want this space to actually be? We have a firehouse in Stevens Point. We out in this tiny little village between Stevens Point and Amherst called Nelsonville. There's the Rising Star Mill, which is it's the prettiest place on earth, I'll tell you that, right on the Tamara River. And then in Plover, just south of Stevens Point, we have a historical village that is 11 different structures. I say structures because one's a caboose. But we care for those buildings as well. And so maintenance is a continuous process. So restoration isn't a one-time thing. It's something you got to keep doing.
And I believe you have been able to complete over a couple $100,000.
Yeah.
In deferred maintenance.
Yeah. And so there was a lot of stuff on hold when I came in. And this, you know, when you're talking about maintenance and building materials, it's only going to get more expensive. So the quicker you can get on top and really rein in some of those issues, because old buildings are really expensive things, the better you're going to be as an organization. Or if you own a historic building, you already know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
So,
Janet, is there state funding available for restoring local historic sites?
The funding for local historical societies primarily comes from local communities. The support that is available for local communities, whether that's local historical societies, business owners, or homeowners, that is part of our State Historic Preservation Office and the tax credit program. And you can find a lot of information and the contact information online at wisconsinhistory.org. But that's through our State Historic Preservation Office. And they also our team there offers great support and guidance for local community members as well. So I encourage people to check out that part of our website and look to the expertise in our preservation office for support with those preservation projects.
Joe in Rhinelander has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Yeah, I've got a question. My wife and I worked in Amherst in the early 1970s, I think 71, 72. And we had a good friend named Wendell Nelson, who wrote several books on the history of old homes in Portage County. And I wonder if their guest knows of him and if he's still around.
Unfortunately, Wendell passed away in 2020 or 2021. I'd have to look. I knew him as a community member. I actually was at our archives, and he had a eureka moment and was like, aha, I found it. So that's my best memory of Wendell. Wendell was a great local historian. He was kind of the keeper of all the stories of a lot of different things, but he was a big architectural historian. And when he passed away, he had written several different books, a number of which the inventory got donated to us. And then all of his research files that he had, because this is in the days before like newspapers.com and all this stuff. And he would assemble these research files by topic. And then so you would thematically then be like, okay, am I looking for history of this certain tavern or this certain business or a different house or whatever? And then he would have all the clippings or legal documents in just one file. And I can say that we have digitized all of that. So that all of those are now in our Wendell Nelson research collection that if you, you know, email us and talk to our curator, that's a great way to get a research project started, is to see what we have.
That's amazing.
From that. Yeah. Unfortunately, he's not still around, but his legacy absolutely is living on with the hard work that he did for our community.
Joe, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Speaking of digitizing, you know, anytime I can see a book or information on my local community's history, I'm all there. And I see your society has spent years digitizing photo negatives kept by the Stevens Point Journal newspaper.
Yeah, well, that ownership has changed hands, and in between one of the ownership hands, we got not all of them, but a lot of the photo negatives dating back to the 1930s for the Stevens Point Journal. They are very fragile things. So they're not like, if you think back to photo negatives that like I grew up with, that comes on a roll and they're very small.
Yeah.
These negatives are actually 4x5. They're huge.
Oh.
And so there's a lot of data you can get off of those. But the unfortunate thing is they're made up of an acidic compound. And they degrade over time. So if you were to open one of those boxes now, it's what's called vinegar syndrome, because you'd get a whiff of this acid vinegar coming off of them that removes the backing of the photo from the photo negative. And once that happens, you can't get that data off, and it's basically something lost. And so we had a volunteer start with us who was his name's Andy Barnett, and he was the director of the library in Wisconsin Rapids for a long time, and he lives at Stevens Point. And now he's retired, and he was looking for something to occupy him and that he could contribute with his unique skill set. And basically, he took this thing on like head first. And not only does he, you know, he works with other people, we have interns and other volunteers working on digitizing. He also goes and does the research and finds the newspaper so we can find the clippings. So if there's a caption with it, then we know who's in the photo, which is really cool, because that might be the only photo that existed of, say, your grandfather or great-grandpa or something. So really powerful stuff. And through Andy's help and with our curator, I think we're over 7,000 photos digitized now.
Oh, boy.
We still got, like, 13,000 to go.
I imagine you're going to have some kind of display at some point of all this.
Yeah, well, they all end up throughout the other exhibit. So we just launched our exhibit on music history, and it's like, do we have a photo of the Almond, Wisconsin band? We do, in 1951, because they were in the newspaper. And so using our, you know, database to find these things, it's, you know, maybe we'll do something that has these photos more prominently recognized, but it's really,
you're using
just,
them right
they're
now.
They're just added into the content that we're building.
That's so cool. Jim and Stevens Point, we'll go to you now. Jim, hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Just wanted to mention, and I've lived in Stevens Point for a long time, and what John and his staff have been able to do, from my perspective, is to really increase public knowledge and perception of the Historical Society. I think for a long time, people knew it as a bunch of buildings and old buildings in Plover, and they were being renovated. And what they've been able to do is create different opportunities for people. I like music, and one of the things they did this summer was to have a musical series out at that Rising Star Mill that John mentioned in Nelsonville. You know, it had bluegrass, it had blues, just some great music, and people who had never gone into that building all of a sudden see what the Historical Society is doing. So they've just been able to create different opportunities for people to understand who and what the Historical Society does.
Well, Jim, thank you so much for calling. John?
I know that guy. awareness is the key, right? And that's, I think, to my earlier point, is I want to make sure people know not only what we're doing, but that our mission is important. Because I think that all gets, you know, back to how do we get people in the pipeline to learning about what we do more as our mission through some of these more tangential things. The Rising Star Mill is the best concert venue that I've ever been in, by the way. So maybe Larry will get you up for a concert there soon. But it's, you know, I think local historical societies have a unique perspective on their communities. We are one of the few nonprofits that could actually directly impact every single person in the communities we serve. Because every person is important. Every person has an important story. And so, you know, being able to get more people involved through these different activities is really important so that they start to find themselves in what we're doing.
Yeah. Janet, comment from you.
the work that the Portage County Historical Society has done to make history accessible is one of the reasons they're being honored this year with the Thwaites Trophy. And that's everything from, you know, just accessibility with digitizing photographs. So people can see themselves in the stories and the programs. So when you visit Portage County Historical Society, you can see yourself there. And so that is something to be commended, the accessibility in sharing and honoring people's stories and in the community.
And I think just bringing people together and people who may never have otherwise been involved in history, you have so many ways to bring people together. Brewing history is one. You wrote your master's thesis on people's brewing company in Oshkosh.
Yes.
The first African-American-owned brewery in Wisconsin. What fascinates you about brewery?
Well, that came from when I was going back to school. The professors at UWSP said, you got to pick a research area. And I first said, well, I'm going to study American history. And they said, well, that's a little broad. So maybe pick something a little more focused. And I was like, well, I really enjoy craft beer, and I collect beer antiques and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And so, that kind of story just popped out as people, again, it kind of gets into not only awareness of an organization and a mission, but an awareness of some of these really interesting stories that our communities hold within them. So, so I did my master's thesis on that. That work led me to be the intern for the beer historian at the Smithsonian National Museum of American History in 2019. somebody had to do it, so I was there. But I'm also now through all this, too, I wrote the book on the history of the Stevens Point Brewery, which is one of the nation's oldest breweries, and I lead history tours, and they're a great partner because they basically donate all the product and the ticket proceeds to us so we can do these history tours of Point Brewery. So I would be happy to show anybody. That's one of my one of my favorite parts of my job. But with beer history, you get so many, you know, when you talk about Peoples being the first black-owned brewery in the state, well, you're not just talking about beer at that point then. You're talking about minority business and politics. And with the Stevens Point Brewery, you're not just talking about beer. You're talking about immigration and community. So there's different layers to good history.
I was on a 500-mile bike ride across Wisconsin one time, and one of our stops was Stevens Point, and the Point Brewery was providing free beer for those of us who were biking. And
Did you partake?
I had a couple, but then I still had 50 miles to bike that day.
That's the challenge.
So I left, but I left reluctantly. We'll put it that way. But it's great, and so many things that you are doing just bring it's. They're fun things that bring people together, mm-hmm. and they're learning at the same time.
I think it's important that we create these opportunities for human connection in a world that's quickly being dominated by artificial intelligence. I think that's something that, like, if you're frustrated with that, go get active in your local historical society and rediscover that wonderful piece of human connection that we all share.
One that I wanted to go to. You have a couple of Halloween-themed events.
Sure.
And you've got the Murder on Main Street.
Yeah. So we have it's always on October 18th. And it's actually not a Halloween-themed tour. It's a true crime murder-themed tour. But it happens every October 18th because it is the anniversary. It's actually the 150th this year, 150th anniversary of Stevens Point's only lynching. Now, it was not a racial lynching, which I guess is good, but it's also a lynching, so it's bad. Some brothers killed the sheriff, and then as they were held in the jail at the courthouse, a mob broke them out, and let's just say you won't just get the stories of like that, but we have some of the different souvenirs or items that might correspond to some of these historic murders throughout Stevens Point. But there's been enough murders in Stevens Point historically to do like an hour and a half walking tour on them. So Stevens Point used to be a pretty rough and tumble lumber town. So that's one of the things coming up. And then we have cemetery tours that we do at one of our cemeteries. We have a great person that we work with who researched tirelessly about Forest Cemetery in Stevens Point. And then we do trick-or-treating out at Heritage Park, too, so you can get the family involved and get candy.
Becky and Ryo will give you a chance. Hi, Becky.
Hi, how are you?
Great.
I have a question to see if your guests are familiar with a novel called Remember Me Dancing. I cannot remember the author's name, but it was County, and it was a wonderful story of the Polish immigrants to the area, the generational.
Oh, you're breaking up. But the book, the novel, is set in Portage County.
Yeah, I think I'm familiar with that. Portage County has a huge Polish population, and our community is very proud of that Polish heritage. By 1900, 10,000 Poles lived in Portage County, which was a third of the population there. And so every fall, there's a Polish harvest festival that we do, and we have a number of different book titles on the Polish history. So I'll have to see if we have that specific one.
That was a book by Ken Pareko, I believe.
Okay.
Parejko.
Sounds Polish.
Yeah. I used to pick up, back in the day when I worked for Armstrong Produce, I used to drive a truck to that area and pick up 150, 100-pound bags of potatoes.
Yep. Yep. Potatoes and Polish stuff. That's our heritage up there.
Man. Well, I tell you, this has been so much fun. So how are you? I mean, are you happy with how things are going?
Oh my God, over the moon! I couldn't, in our wildest dreams, imagine that, you know, almost 4 years into having paid staff, that we'd have added on what we have. I think the future is bright. I think our best days are ahead of us as the Portage County Historical Society.
And your hope?
My hope is that we can keep building on this success, and that people will keep responding so positively to it, and that contributions will follow that, so we can continue.
And Janet, your thoughts?
Well, it's been a really fun conversation, and also a nice way to continue honoring the good work that John Harry and the Portage County Historical Society, the staff, the board, the volunteers are doing there in Stevens Point, really bringing history to the community and encouraging people to have fun and learn, as you said, but really outstanding work. And so it was just a pleasure to also hear from folks from around the state, wonderful local historical societies in all of the communities that folks called in from today, bringing to mind a lot of wonderful volunteers working across the state in those communities to bring history
to life.
Yeah.
Well, John, Janet, thank you both very much for being with us today. John Harry is Executive Director of the Portage County Historical Society. Take a look at their website. They got a lot of cool stuff going on that we talked about. Portage County Historical Society. Janet Seymour, she has a lot going on, too, because she's Outreach Director for the Wisconsin Historical Society. Great to have them with us. Coming up, our executive producer, Jill Nadeau, will be bringing us a conversation she had yesterday with American humorist and author David Sedaris. I'm Larry Mueller. Stay with us here on WPR News.
Radio listeners are very familiar with the voice and musings of David Sedaris, and I am excited to chat with him today about his upcoming visits to Wisconsin. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. David is an American humorist, comedian, author, and radio contributor. He's written a series of New York Times bestsellers, and his collection of essays, Me Talk Pretty One Day, won the Thurber Prize for American Humor. He's been nominated for Grammys, he's written plays, and now you can call him Doctor because he was awarded an honorary Doctor of Literature by the University of Chichester. I could go on, but I'm sure you want to hear from him and not me. David Sedaris, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. You know, the only thing I would correct is that I'm not a comedian.
Okay.
Sometimes people call me a comedian.
Sure.
Like last night I did a show and there was a Q&A And this person in the audience said, I like the first part of your stand-up act. And I thought, stand-up? I've never done stand-up in my life, you know? I mean, I always have, my papers protect me. Mm-hmm. So if you took my papers away and if you wanted me to go on stage, I wouldn't be able to do it.
That's difficult. I've always thought that when I've watched a stand-up person, it's like, oh my gosh, that's got to be so nerve-wracking.
I couldn't do it to save my life. There's an energy to it also that most often I don't care for that energy. You know, like someone prowls the stage. How's everybody doing tonight? It just seems very confrontational to me.
I understand what you're saying. It's almost like, okay, audience, now you have to come through for me. So did I say Chichester correctly?
Yeah.
Okay. Chichester. Now, you're living in England, was it most of the time these days?
Yeah, about, I feel like I'm traveling for like 4 months of the year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I spend some time in New York, and I spend some time in England. So it's about half and half with New York and England.
Wonderful. I'm jealous. Does living abroad, you know, let you see the United States a little differently than if you think you were just pretty much situated here all the time?
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. I mean, before England, I lived in France. So I really like living abroad. I like that people treat you like you don't really matter. And I like being treated like that because it's like giving me material, right?
Oh, sure. Because people, do they act differently around you when they know who you are?
When they know who I am?
Yeah.
See, I have a radio show in England.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a radio show on the BBC in England. So a lot of times I'll be in England and people will just recognize me by my voice.
Sure.
Right?
Yeah.
But by and large, if I meet people and they don't know who I am, they just think I'm on vacation, right?
Right.
Or they think that, or, you know, they think I just could not possibly truly get their country. And there are a lot of things you really do, I feel, have to be born there in order to truly get, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, that totally makes sense.
A mindset in England that is so fundamentally different than in the United States. Just a kind of a culture of envy. And I mean, I don't know. I see that changing. I saw it starting to change in the U.S. with the pandemic. But I've said this a million times before, but like the change amount, I mean, the difference amounts to, in the United States, if your next door neighbor has a Rolls Royce, you want one too. And in England, if your next door neighbor has a Rolls Royce, you want him to die in a fiery accident. So, and it's just such a completely different way of approaching the world.
That is an interesting observation, which, of course, we know you are very, very good at. Have you always been like that?
I mean, I think I always paid attention.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, literally now I'm one of the few people paying attention because everybody else is just on their phone all the time.
Right.
You know?
Oh, so annoying.
Everybody. Uh-huh. I mean, I could have walked into my hotel restaurant naked this morning and nobody would have noticed it, right?
And if they did, you would you would have been going viral for sure.
Well, the waiter would have noticed it, I guess. He was the only one, like, not looking down at a device.
Oh, yes. Well, I just saw something the other day, a story about schools not allowing phones in the classrooms, in the school even sometimes. I think that's a good idea?
I think that's a wonderful idea. Mm-hmm. You know, and what's interesting to me is so often it's the parents who fight it. You know, I need to be able to get in contact with my child.
Sure.
Well, and I know this makes me sound terribly old, but, you know, no one had a cell phone when I was growing up. And the way that it works is if you need to get a hold of your child, you call the office and someone in the school office goes to the classroom and fetches you.
Yep.
That's how that works.
Yep.
It's not impossible. I mean, just people I know who teach is just so, you know, it's you just have to be a cop the whole time,
yeah,
you know. And
yeah,
people are looking at their phones, and you've got the whole class becomes about that, about scolding people and policing people, and it's just got to be exhausting.
Oh, absolutely. I just couldn't believe that they actually allowed it in the first place. Whose idea was that? We're about the same age, so I had the same thing, and God forbid you get called to the office over the intercom. Then it was probably someone died. For sure someone died. So,
yeah, it was never, how'd first period go?
Right.
Right. It was never the dumb stuff that people text about.
Exactly.
Did you like that lunch I made you?
Yes, parents are different these days. So you are in the midst of this tour. You said you're in Connecticut, I believe, on your way to, was it New York area, Homer?
I was in the Berkshires.
Oh, okay.
And so now I'm on my way, yeah, to Homer,
mm-hmm,
New York.
Okay. And you're in a car because you don't drive and someone is driving you. So you must get a chance to really see the countryside. Beautiful time of year to be doing this.
Yeah, and what I like about it, too, is that, you know, sometimes you miss the autumn, right? Like what I'm seeing right now on my window is just sort of not terribly impressive, you know?
Yeah.
But then I'll be in Wisconsin, and then I'll be in Montana, and I'll be in Utah, and being the most beautiful autumn.
Yeah.
The most beautiful is Chico, California.
Really?
You wouldn't expect it.
No, not
and
at
it
all.
It waits for me. Chico always waits until I get there to have peak weekend.
Well, you definitely have influence, apparently. I was going to ask you about that. I mean, you tour a lot. And do you have favorite places that you like to go each time you go on tour?
Favorite places usually have to do with having friends there,
mm-hmm,
or having a hotel. I mean, having a hotel that I look forward to.
Sure,
right?
Yeah.
So I look forward to going to San Francisco, and I look forward to going to Seattle, and I look forward to, you know, seeing people I know in, you know, if I go to North Carolina, I see my family. I see my cousins a lot. Like, I'm the only one in my family who has a relationship with my cousins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just because I go on tour and I see them all the time.
I love that. So what do you do to keep yourself from getting exhausted? Is it those people that you know that's helpful?
No, I actually like being on tour.
Okay.
You know, I'm sad when it's over because it gives me a chance. What I do is I started out this tour with 7 new essays. And so I read them and go back to my room and rewrite them and read them and rewrite them. And, you know, the audience pretty much tells me when it's working and when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
If I were reading something serious, I might be at a loss, but I'm trying to write humor. And so when they laugh, that lets me know, oh, that worked. And so if something doesn't work, like there's an essay that I've been reading that there's in which I think of telling a joke to an AI character, right?
Uh-huh.
But I don't actually tell the joke, right? I just think of doing it. So I can swap that out for any number of jokes, right?
Sure.
So it's been interesting swapping it out every night for a different joke. Like the joke I thought was going to just kill, people just, they groaned in a way that, like they were being sick. I was making them sick.
Geez.
It's just what I always liked about the joke. But then I thought, no, this joke's job is to just get a massive laugh. So I have been swapping it out. But it's fun. That's fun for me.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, that is similar to a comedian because you do need to have a rhythm. You need to have an emphasis to what you're saying, how you're saying it. The timing has to be just right.
Right. And it can take – sometimes I'll read an essay out loud the first time, and I'll think, oh, that's not – you know, I just need to throw that away. But then I remember, you know, it takes a while to learn how to read something,
mm-hmm,
you know. And sometimes it takes a good long while to learn how to read it, you know, to get the voices down and to, again, the timing and the pauses. And so, but it's all fun to me, you know.
Well, we're all happy about that. Yeah, we're always happy about that because you are continuing to tour and we can see you more often with new material. It's always exciting. We're going to take a quick little break, but before we do, I want to just mention that you are going to be in Wisconsin for four different appearances. October 16th, you'll be at the Pabst in Milwaukee. The 17th, you'll be in the Meyer Theater in Green Bay. The 18th, you're going to be at the Historic Temple Theater in Viroqua. And then October 22nd, you're going to be at the Overture Center in Madison. And we'll be back in just a sec to talk more about it. I'm Jill Nadeau, and this is The Larry Mueller Show. Hope you can join us tomorrow. We're going to be talking about the history of apples, both the history in the world and in Wisconsin. And then we'll talk with some folks from the International Crane Center in Baraboo. And right now, we are talking with the American humorist David Sedaris. So, David, we were just talking about you coming to Wisconsin. Do you have a favorite place you like to eat or a place you like to go when you're in Wisconsin?
Well, I love that frozen custard.
Oh, yeah.
And so anywhere that I see it, I'd like to get it. I like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I like big, fat Wisconsin hot dogs.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, okay. I think we can get a lot of people that get behind that for sure.
I went to the Art Institute of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the fall every year, we would drive up into Wisconsin, you know, and stay in motels.
Uh-huh.
And I don't even know if places like that even exist anymore. I wonder if it isn't all like, you know, AmeriSuites or, you know, like corporate places.
There's still some mom and pop ones up, especially in northern Wisconsin. Yeah.
And they were just so, I mean, I wasn't in the habit of staying in hotels, so I didn't really have, you know, all I cared about was knotty pine paneling. That's all I cared about.
I believe that's a law in northern Wisconsin that you have to have that.
Well, I have good feelings about Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm. We're a friendly place. Have you found that to be the case?
Well, especially compared to where I live. I mean, we live half in England, half in London,
mm-hmm.
and then half in West Sussex. And West Sussex is an hour and 15 minutes by train south of London. And the countryside is unspeakably beautiful.
Yes.
And it looks like, it just looks like a BBC program, you know.
Uh-huh.
And even British friends are like, oh, okay, come on. You know, we live outside of a village with 27 houses and they all have thatched roofs. Oh. And there's a 12th century church. And the people are so cold. You've never met colder people.
Really?
If you say hello to somebody, they will say nothing in return. Pass somebody, they in their front yard, and you say something, they will turn their back to you.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't know what their problem is.
Well, I thought it was the French that we had to worry about. Now I hear it's the English.
Well, in Normandy, when Hugh and I lived in Normandy, it was the same thing. I don't know. They're just very suspicious people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're not in the north of England, you know. In the north of England, you can't shut people up, but it's a southern thing. Whereas usually people in the south are warmer, mm-hmm. you know, than people in the north. But it's just the opposite in England.
Yeah. Wow. That's interesting. I'll have to remember that next time I'm in the UK. We were speaking of the UK, and you're doing this series of essays for the BBC. It's BBC Four. What's that experience been like doing that?
Well, it's been really nice. I mean, I'm so grateful to have an audience in another country, right?
Yeah.
And being on the BBC allows me to tour England in a way. You know, I can go to, like, a city the size of Chichester, or I can go to a city, you know, I can go to Oxford, or I can go to Cambridge, or I can go to a small city,
mm-hmm.
and still have an audience, but it's all because of being on the radio.
Ah, yeah. Well, that makes sense.
You can pick out a Radio 4 listener. You know, like if there were two Radio 4 listeners in a room with 100 people, you'd go right to them. In the same way that you can often identify a public radio listener.
I was just going to say, it's got to be the same. Yeah, you can just tell.
And if you went through their trash, you'd really be able to tell.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
You know, like they recycle and compost.
Oh, my gosh. Right? Definitely. Do you watch the BBC? Do you have a favorite show?
I love a show. I mean, Hugh watches all kinds of things. I told myself I can only watch anything if I'm at the fitness center on the elliptical machine.
Ah. Mm-hmm.
So Hugh watches all these procedurals, you know, these police shows.
Yeah.
You know, British. But the best British show is called Motherland. And it's on, I don't know that you can get it here. It's on Netflix in the UK, but I don't know if it's on here. And it's simply the funniest show ever. And then Staff Lets Flats. Staff Lets Flats. And it's about this British Greek fellow who rents out apartments.
Oh.
And that's terribly funny, too.
I'm sure it is. And being part Greek yourself, you probably appreciate it more.
Well, I do. He's Greek. And then his sister's on the show, too. So it's brother and sister Greeks. So that makes me like it even more.
Well, of course. Because, of course, most people know Amy Sedaris is your sister. And you two actually have worked together quite a bit, haven't you?
Yeah, we did a number of plays together under the name The Talent Family.
Which I love.
So it was such an audacious name. And we kept waiting for the, you know, we could just see the reviews. You know, there would be Talentless Family, but actually it all went pretty well for us, you know.
Yeah. Well, I have to admit that before I started doing a little background here for this, I didn't know you did plays, and I do theater myself. And so I'm like, oh, I have got to do one of your plays because I think it would be so much fun. So what is it like working with your sister? I mean, you just kind of get in a room and just do normal stuff because you're always funny together, or do you have to really work at it?
Well, I mean, Amy doesn't write. I mean, she doesn't mm-hmm. put words on paper, you
okay.
know, but she has good ideas.
Ah.
So we would get together and then I would type up all the ideas and form it into a script. And then every single time we would get the cast together and then we would have a read through. And then we would throw everything away and start from scratch.
Sure.
And so we let them improvise and we would, I think, and then we would use lines that they came up with. You know, if their lines were better than ours.
Oh, yeah.
You know, you just want to always go with the funniest thing. You don't want to let your ego get involved and then say, well, you know, we're going to do what I wrote because I wrote it.
Oh, yeah. That is a very good way to do it. Go ahead.
For certain people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we never wrote something and then we always had the cast in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so David Rakoff was one of the people we worked with always. And then when David died, I couldn't really imagine. I don't know. I just couldn't imagine doing a play without him. So we haven't done one since.
Sure. Yeah, that's got to be kind of hard. So, you know, you've got downtime between your shows and you're working on obviously your material, but do you get a chance to, you know, watch movies or read a book? What do you like to do?
Oh gosh, I'm usually just rewriting all the time.
Okay.
I don't have a chance to write movies. I have this problem, well, a couple problems, right? So I'm a slave to my Apple Watch, so I have to walk 10 miles a day.
Okay. No.
So that means that if a car is coming to get me to take me to the airport at 8, I'm up at 6 so I can walk 3 miles before breakfast and then walk another 3 miles in the airport and then walk another 4 miles when I get to the town.
Oh,
and then I have to do this Duolingo, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So I have to do that like an hour a day. So then what I've done is now I combine the two. And so I walk while I'm doing my Duolingo. It's really embarrassing. Something's got to give.
I was going to say, people are going to put you away and you keep doing that stuff. Hey, I was a slave to Duolingo, trying to learn French, which really appreciated your Me Talk Pretty Tea One Day's book, because I'm terrible at it. I'm just horrible. And I finally, I'm like, you know what? This is driving me crazy. I'm not looking forward to this. It's like the worst thing I'm doing all day. I'm not getting any better. And I dropped it. What are you?
Well, one of the essays that I'm working on is they had an update on Duolingo, right?
Uh-huh.
And the update allows you to have role-playing exercises and then video conversations with Lily, who's one of the characters.
Yes, Lily.
But she's the character you don't want to talk to, right?
You're right.
She's like the teenage character who's just sarcastic.
Uh-huh.
And if she says, what do you want? What do you want to buy? And if you say milk and eggs, she'll say, oh, that's original, isn't it? And I say, I have a baby at home. And my baby doesn't care whether it's original. Those are the only two things my baby can eat because my baby has cancer.
And what does Lily say back to that?
Well, see, before the upgrade, right, she would have just said, well, what about buying some candy?
Uh-huh.
But now, the latest upgrade, she remembers everything you've told her.
Oh, my gosh.
And she's not sarcastic. And if you tell her that your baby has cancer, then the next time you talk, she's going to say, how's your baby? And what are the doctors saying? Have you gotten any news? And then it's like, oh, no, I got trapped in this lie, right?
Yeah. Now you've got to remember all those lies.
Sometimes she'll hang up on me, right? Oh. Like this morning, she asked what I wanted for my birthday. I told her that I wanted a seal, right?
Okay.
I said, but the word for seal is a very dirty word in English, right?
Okay.
And so she hung up on me. She said, I won't continue this conversation. And she hung up on me.
Oh.
And so I called her back and I said, a seal. I said, an animal like a dog that lives in the ocean, a seal. And she said, I will not talk to you like this, and hung up on me again.
Oh, wow.
But I don't think I was mispronouncing it.
That's kind of depressing, though, you know, with this AI Lily chick is, you know, kind of dissing you there.
I can see now for the first time how AI would be a real aid to lonely people.
Sure.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because when she sympathizes with you and her eyes, even though they're just dots, in circles,
mm-hmm.
they assume such warmth, and she cocks her head, and you feel such a kinship with her.
Yeah.
And it, so I could understand if it was someone who looked like a real person,
mm-hmm.
how easy it would be to become attached,
yeah.
and even fall in love with a being like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they become real. They become real. So have you...
And right now, it's just in its infancy. Can
yeah.
you imagine 10 years from now?
It's kind of scary. Hopefully, it'll go in a good direction. Are you concerned that they're going to start writing humorous books like David Sedaris?
Yeah, but I feel that that's just right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
And now, me personally, I wouldn't want to... Like, if you had an art exhibit... and it was a computer that made the art, I don't really care to go because I don't know, it just doesn't interest me. I like the idea of a person being supported, you know? Like a machine being supported doesn't mean anything to me.
Yeah.
So, but that's just me. And I think plenty of other people won't care.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I just think it's coming for everyone's job. And I consider myself very lucky that I'm 68. You know?
Yeah.
And by the time, you know, I could retire tomorrow if I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
But I would feel bad if I were like 23.
Yeah.
I would feel like really threatened.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's kind of like being in public media these days. You just never
yeah.
know.
Yeah.
And I kind of feel the same way. I'm near that age. It's like, yeah, I could always retire, but the people who are in their 30s and 40s can't. So, this has gone really fast. I really appreciate you spending some time with us, David. It's been a joy. Been a big fan of yours for years, and you've gotten me through a lot of stuff. So thank you.
Gosh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Bye-bye. We've been talking with David Sedaris. He's an American humorist, and he is going to be in Wisconsin. He's going to be in Milwaukee, Green Bay, Viroqua, and Madison. So just Google his tour, and those tickets are still available. Thanks for joining us today. This and all our other shows are a team effort, of course. Thank you to Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, Jeff Robbins, Larry Mueller, of course, and I'm Jill Nadeau. Thanks for your interest.